You're listening to the New Yorker Poetry Podcast. I'm Paul Muldoon, the poetry editor of the magazine, and it's a pleasure to welcome you here today. As you may recall, on this podcast, we invite a poet to choose a poem from the New Yorker archive. We read it, we discuss it, and then we ask them to read one of their own poems that's been published in the magazine, and we read that and we discuss it. And my guest this week is Tom Slay. Tom Slay, the recipient of so many honours, the Guggenheim, the American Academy in Berlin, and the Shelley Prize from the Poetry Society of America. Welcome, Tom Slay.
Paul, it's good to be here.
Now, the poem you have chosen is a poem by Seamus Heaney. Seamus Heaney, a man whom you knew quite well.
Yeah, and one of the reasons why I've chosen a poem, it's called In the Attic, was because I saw it in an issue of the New Yorker that you edited. And as soon as I saw the title of it, I remembered about well over 30 years ago, the very first time I visited Seamus in Dublin. This was before he'd renovated the house, and during the renovation, he referred to the house as the bomb site, which I remember that quite well. But this was before all of that, and I spent the night up in the attic, and it was a wonderful place, overcrowded with books. It had a kind of friendly chaos about it, which I absolutely loved.
But he probably knew you exactly in the time-honored way. He knew exactly where everything was.
Exactly. And that was a thing that was amazing, because when you went up there, you know how he was very particular and had a kind of mind like a steel trap for all kinds of, you know, detritus, quotations. I remember once when I was there during that visit, this is just exactly the kind of thing that I think you probably noticed in him frequently, was he put on the stairs various stuff that the kids back in those days were, of course, full grown now. He put things on the stairs, and I said, "Well, why are you doing that, Seamus?" And he said, "Well, it's kind of an experiment to see if the children will pick them up and carry them up the stairs." And I said, "How is the experiment going?" And he just smiled at me and said, "Well, it's an ongoing experiment."
Now, of course, the attic itself was the place where he conducted so many of his own experiments. This isn't the first poem in which he wrote about his workspace. There's an earlier poem. I remember quite vividly his description of it as being like a deep litter, being in deep litter.
Yeah, the deep litter of the study. I remember that poem very well. He's talking about lighting one cigarette off another. And it's just a wonderful image of him up there. He's talking about how it's all hutch and hatch rather than what it later turned into, which these magnificent skylights looking out over the Irish Sea.
The hutch and hatch, the hatch, of course, is a word that's connected intimately to the idea of deep litter. A deep litter, of course, is a way of raising hens. One raises them
in... I didn't know that.
Well, one raises them in deep litter. I mean, when I was a kid, the farmers would say, I'm trying the deep litter. And what that meant was that they were raising them on peat.
Huh.
Yeah, the bales of peat or turf broken down, and the hens were scrambling around there, and it was a representation of what you might think of as their natural habitat. So I wondered, actually, to what extent the term deep litter would even have resonated beyond the hen-keeping community.
Well, for me, it was more about kind of the deep litter of the mind.
Well, of course.
The idea that it's... is rooted in something as physical, as daily as that. That's very typical of Seamus.
It is. And as I say, it's where the hutch and the hatch come from, the hatch in particular, and the incubation, as it were, up there in the attic. Anything else we should know about this poem before you read it for us?
Oh, well, there's just a couple of things. The poem takes as a springboard both the book by Robert Louis Stevenson of Treasure Island, and also the movie. And I was curious. I hadn't seen the movie or read the book in many, many years. And so I reread them just like the last few days. the book is absolutely marvelous.
Well, you know, I have to say it may be, there are so many books one could choose from, I think it may be my own favorite book.
You know, Paul, I think it's really up at the top for me too.
And what makes it so brilliant?
Well, for me, it's that kind of limpid, no sweat English prose in which everything is registered descriptively with perfect accuracy and in a syntax that you feel absolutely tracks the speaker's consciousness as they're perceiving things.
The cast of characters.
Oh.
Each one of these characters is so fully drawn.
Absolutely.
Starting with, you know, the old sea captain.
Yeah, right. Billy Bones.
But those other characters, you know, every last one of them, including the mother, then Blind Pugh.
Oh.
Then Silver himself, of course. Then the kind of Robinson Crusoe lookalike.
Ben Gunn.
And then, Israel Hands, who features in this poem.
Yeah, he does feature in the poem. And one of the things about the poem that I love is the way in which the story, Treasure Island, picks a single moment out of the book and, in fact, the movie, which is, in a way, climactic. There's a particular moment in the book when everything's gone awry, of course, and the pirates and the Jim and his friends are now both going after the treasure, but they're also at each other's throats. And so Jim goes back to the boat, which the pirates have taken over, and he finds Israel Hands on the boat. And Israel Hands and Jim end up in this strange kind of fight in which Jim begins to climb the rigging with Israel Hands after him. And Israel Hands has been wounded in the meantime from another fight. So he's coming up very slowly, and Jim climbs all the way up to the cross trees, which is the very top of the boat, in the crow's nest. And Israel Hands is climbing up the rigging, and he's got a knife, and Jim has two pistols. And the first time he shot the pistols, the powder's been fouled because they've fallen in water, so he has to reprime them as Israel's climbing. And it's very, very tense, very, mm-hmm. very exciting. And what happens is that Israel Hands hurls the knife from about 15 feet. He pins Jim's shoulder
yes.
to the mast. And then
through his shirt.
Exactly. And then Jim fires the pistols almost involuntarily and kills Hands. And Hands plunges all the way down into the sea because the ship has run aground and is canted at an angle. And Jim looks down, and because of the current, it looks as if Hands is still moving, still alive.
And he refers, I think, I read this book at least once a year.
Oh,
and I
my
think
gosh.
The phrase that he uses, he describes him lying there on the sand. He can see him right down on the bottom on the sand with the quick fishes steering over him.
Exactly.
And he's a genius, this guy. So Seamus Heaney, another genius, takes up this image from Robert Louis Stevenson. Let's hear now In the Attic by Seamus Heaney, and it's read here today by Tom Slay.
Like Jim Hawkins, aloft in the cross trees of Hispaniola, nothing underneath him but still green water and clean bottom sand, the ship aground, the canted mast far out above a sea floor where striped fish pass in shoals. And when they've passed, the face of Israel Hands that rose in the shrouds before Jim shot him dead appears to rise again. But he was dead enough, the story says, being both shot and drowned. A birch tree planted 20 years ago comes between the Irish Sea and me at the attic skylight, a man marooned in his own loft, a boy ship-shaped in the crow's nest of a life, airbrushed to and fro, wind-drunk, braced by all that's thrumming up from keel to masthead, rubbing his eyes to believe them, and this most buoyant, billowy, top-gallant birch. Goes footing what was then the terra firma of hallway linoleum. Grandfather now appears, his voice a waver like the draft-prone screen they'd set up in the club rooms earlier for the matinee I've just come back from. At Isaac Hands, he asks, was Isaac in it? His memory of the name a waver too, his mistake perpetual, once and for all, like the single splash when Israel's body fell. As I age and blank on names, as my uncertainty on stairs is more and more the lightheadedness of a cabin boy's first time on the rigging, as the memorable bottoms out into the irretrievable, it's not that I can't imagine still that slight untoward rupture and world tilt as a wind freshened and the anchor weighed.
Beautiful. I notice you were reading there from that version that was published in the final volume itself.
Yeah, 2010, yeah. Human Chain.
Human Chain. As it appeared in the magazine, in fact, it was ghost footing what was then the terra firma of hallway linoleum. Grandfather now appears above me just back from the matinee.
Oh, my goodness.
And he changed that, of course, because it sounds as if grandfather is just back from the matinee rather than above me.
Right,
me,
right.
Me just back from the matinee.
Right.
I know that Seamus Heaney, along with many poets, of course, kept revising right down to the end.
Yeah, that was something that I always loved about Seamus. As over the years, I'm sure just as he did with me, I'm sure he did it with you, he would send me drafts of poems. And the thing that was most remarkable is that sometimes he encouraged me to be frank, and mm-hmm. so I was. And his sort of command to me, both in person and on the page, was, now, Tom, hit it.
Well, that's right. And frankly, unless a poet has that capacity to be able to listen to what people have to say to him or her and to actually maybe even act upon it, they're probably in deep trouble.
I agree with you. The real danger with any poet, I think, is learning to do too well what you already know how to do. And I think for Seamus, do you remember, Paul, when he published Seeing Things? I was so astonished by those poems. It was like almost a completely different way to write. And it just reminded me that a lot of, living, a lot of, life events go into making a style, and then unmaking a style is just as arduous.
It's not, mind you, that he's absolutely clear of some of his own, say ticks, but when I see buoyant, billowy, top-gallant birch, there is a particular concatenation of three adjectives which appears in several poems.
Well, several many poems.
Well, I think, and of course, what's fascinating about that to me is that I think it's a little bit of a tick, if we may use that term,
sure.
Tick, a habit, T-I-C,
that
he derives actually from a certain Robert Lowell.
I think that's very accurate, actually, because Lowell was a big fire source for him.
He was. But right beside that triplet, as it were, of adjectives, buoyant, billowy, top gallant, birch. Now, one simply may not use the word birch in a poem without summoning another American poet.
Yes, Robert Frost, a swinger of birches, yeah.
And of course, Frost was very big in his firmament also. I would say, I don't know what you would think of this, that all the to-ing and fro-ing on the Isaac Hands and the Israel Hands brings me to another of his heroes or heroines, Elizabeth Bishop. right. having to do with the corrective component that I think we've talked about many a time actually in the podcast. One of her trademarks, one of her tics actually, one might say. I don't necessarily use the word tic in any kind of pejorative sense.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, I mean, these are the, it's through moments like this that we actually see the watermark in many poets. I mean, the great danger, of course, is that they start counterfeiting their own currency,
exactly.
right?
Right. And this, for me, this poem is absolutely, you know, gold from beginning to end. And it's partly, you know, in that string of adjectives, if you didn't have a very specific word, buoyant and billowy, you can see how that could be automatic. But it's the third adjective, you know, the bit of nautical lore from a sail, the topgallant sail, which is, there's the source sail and then the topsail and then the topgallant and then there's a royal sail and a sky sail and all the way up to a moonraker. Well, I love that specificity.
There is. And also each of those words is operating in at least a couple of directions, even topgallant. You know,
absolutely.
Where we come from, I come from an area very close to Seamus Heaney, you know, we would talk about the gallant boys. We would use that term, room, my gallant boys, and give us room to rhyme. And so top gallant is another, not only does it describe a particular, very specific form of sail, but it's having some fun, I think, with the idea of the best of the best. Billowy, in the context of a sea-going narrative, of course, is good fun, buoyant, of course, too. In any case, Tom Slay, thank you so much for introducing us to In the Attic by Seamus Heaney, which was published in the February 9th, 2009 issue of the magazine. In the January 16, 2017 issue of The New Yorker, we were very happy to publish your poem, Tom Slay, your poem, The Fox, and you're going to read that for us now. Anything we need to know in advance? You know, we have the luxury as we're reading a poem on the page or even on a tablet in this modern era of being able to literally one's eye to move around over it. With the ear, in this particular format of the podcast, it's sometimes not a bad idea just to have the advantage, I think, in general, of being alerted to perhaps a reference, an allusion, a term, a, you know, piece of vocabulary that it might be that we might not necessarily know immediately.
Well, I will just say about the poem that, you know, I'm a surfer, and I surfed when I was a boy, and the poem is sort of, it's set in San Diego. And there was a particular beach I loved going to. It was Black's Beach because there was always a very good swell there.
Now, one thing that, if you don't mind my saying, distinguishes you from the late Seamus Heaney is that he was not a surfer. Well, and the fact is that he was deadly afeard of water. And in fact, in one of his poems, he refers to Robert Lowell ribbing him about his fear of water.
Yeah, I remember that poem very well.
But you were out there surfing.
Yes, and it's actually one of the great joys of my life when I go back out there because my mother still lives out there. I go out there to visit her and I get out in the water. I'm terrible now. I used to be pretty good. But now I'm the oldest guy in the waves and I look at the youngsters running right down my throat and all I can do is desperately try to get out of the way and catch another wave. But the great highlights of a life, I think, if you're a surfer, is when you're in a wave that is large enough that as you go into the barrel that it tubes you completely and you shoot out. Now, that doesn't happen very often. The waves have to be fairly big for that to happen, plus you have to be quite skillful.
Right.
So in the poem, I get to imagine myself doing that, whereas in real life, I think I would have eaten my lunch, as we said, back in the day. The Fox. Marine helicopters on maneuver kept dipping towards swells at Black's Beach. My board's poise giving way to free fall of my wave tubing over me. Nubs of wax under my feet as I crouched under the lip, sped across the face, and kicked out. All over southern Cal, a haze settled. As if light breathed that technicolor smog at sunset over San Diego Harbor, where battleships at anchor, just back from patrolling the South China Sea, or having rust scraped off and painted gray. This was my inheritance that lay stretched before me, which is when I felt the underbrush give way and the fox that thrives in my brain, not looking sly, but just at home in his pelt and subtle paws, broke from cover and ran across the yard into the future to sniff my gravestone, piss, and move on. And so I was reborn into my long nose and ears, my coats red, white, and brown, giving off my fox smell lying heavy on the winds, and the years when I'd outsmart guns, poison, dogs, and wire, when the rooster and his hens clucked and ran, crazy with terror at how everything goes still in that way a fox adores, gliding through slow motion drifts of feathers.
The Fox, read there by Tom Slay, who also.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Got it. Can you remember anything of the process of writing that poem?
Well, I think that I'd always wanted to write a poem about surfing. Tom Gunn, who wasn't a surfer, has a very good poem about watching surfers. And then there was a poem by Phil Levine, which I'd always loved, and which Phil turns himself into a fox in Central Park, as a matter of fact. And then, obviously, there's that great poem by Ted Hughes.
You know, Ted Hughes's poem, The Thought Fox, does come to mind here. And one of the things that strikes me about your poem is how it acknowledges that. It has to. It has to acknowledge that. And just the way Seamus Heaney's Birch somehow has to, you know, it has to be acknowledged by him. And yet it moves on. It's not trammeled by that. It's not hampered by it. It's not dragged down by it. And it's partly, I think, because of the beautifully delicate way, actually delicate is a word that Hughes uses, but the delicate way that you bring the underbrush, or actually the fox's brush, which the technical term for a fox tail,
right,
of course, is in the underbrush. And it's almost as if it's hidden in there.
Yeah, and I was delighted, actually, when the fox appeared in the poem, because one of the things I think about poems, and particularly when you have an animal surface in the poem, anyway, at the moment when the fox is kind of impatient with the speaker, and he just says, oh, to heck with you, I'm going to take this poem over now, and it's all going to be a primal sensation, you know?
Now tell me this, for the there might be some readers, because you know, as readers we can be quite persnickety. Some of us might think, well, you know, I thought this poem was going to be about surfing and the beautiful description of the, you know, there's been a kind of little bait and switch here. You know, I thought I was in this surfing poem and now I'm in this fox poem. You know, what's going on?
Well, I think for me that what's going on is that there are two things that are happening that kind of make an interesting hinge. And that is that in the surfing poem, obviously in the background of the poem is the Vietnam War.
Yes. And there is actually the tunnel. I mean, in a way, the tube of the wave is actually a kind of foxhole or tunnel. Is that correct?
I would agree with that. And I think it's a sort of essential that the speaker is being tubed. And that there's a certain kind of danger there, but also a certain kind of elation. And at the end of the poem, clearly the fox is, he's in the hen house and he's killing the chickens. And there's a certain kind of great elation in that act of violence too.
There's an explosive aspect there. Now, but tell us more about the backdrop, if indeed that's the correct term. It's maybe more than a backdrop of the impedimenta of war.
Well, I think that it's very difficult right now, unless you have a kind of firsthand experience, so that the things that happen in war actually imprint on your nervous system, for you to escape the sort of what I think of as the kind of, you know, 5 o'clock news poem in which somebody is watching some catastrophe on a screen. And I often feel that those poems are kind of vitiated by the secondhandness of them in a way. Heaney has a beautiful phrase, just a beautiful phrase, and he calls it the primal reach into the physical. And that's one of the things that unless you find a way to get at some remove from the subject.
Now, you have written a number of quote-unquote war poems.
Yeah, most of it has come out of sort of first-person observation, or actually all of it has.
And that's because you went out to some
war zones. Yes, I've been in Lebanon, I've been in Syria, I've been in Mogadishu, I've been in Libya, I've been in Iraq.
Let me just ask you a very crude question.
Sure.
Please forgive me. It's part of my job, I suppose. What brought you out there?
The first time I just got invited by the Trans Arab Unity Foundation. It was that's a very fancy name for two people who put together this little organization, and they wanted to bring a few American writers to Lebanon to meet and visit Palestinian refugee camps. And when I got there, I mean, I'd never done anything like this before. I mean, believe me, I had no intention of this turning into such a big part of my life. And what happened is that basically a kind of mini civil war broke out while we were there. And suddenly lots of people were being killed and there were car bombs going off all over. And of course, this is part of your historical experience. I mean, you lived through all that, Paul.
Well, you know, I was struck earlier when you, just to bring things round, when you referred to Seamus Heaney's description of his attic as a bomb site. I mean, that is a somewhat loaded, a somewhat charged, as it were, phrase in that context.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I think it's, you know, for me, one of the things that I certainly learned is irony is something that anybody who lives in these conditions, you find in Iraq, you find it in Lebanon, you find it in Libya, you find it in Jordan, where I was just doing a piece on Syrian refugees. There's a tremendous amount of irony which people use to, you know, maintain a sense of their own perspective. And at the same time, I think that what they're really trying to do is to say, well, yes, the world is terrible, but I have my mind, and my mind is empowered to make fun of this. And I think that's a tremendous kind of imaginative gift. And that's one of the things that I always loved about whenever I would meet, you know, people who had, you know, suffered really sometimes almost unspeakable things, was that they had a certain distance from their own experience.
But perhaps not as much distance as so many of us in this country have, where, put very crudely again, I mean, there are many of us who are not entirely sure of how many wars we're actually involved in right now.
I think that's true. You know, there are two things. There's the United States, and then there's everything around the United States. And if you look past the United States, you see that the whole horizon looks to be on fire. And that is just part of, say, one of the things that I loved about, Seamus's, you know, it's a fancy term, but historical consciousness, it's in your work. And the fact that you are aware that, in fact, the horizon is on fire, not in some kind of like grandstanding way, but just as a kind of fact to register.
Tom Slay, I think that's a moment at which to stop and consider your poem again, The Fox, which you read there for us, as well as Seamus Heaney's poem, In the Attic. And both of those are to be found on newyorker.com. Tom Slay's latest book of poems is Station Z.
Yes.
And Seamus Heaney's final collection was The Human Chain, the final book of poems by Seamus Heaney, published posthumously, alas, Selected Poems, 1988 to 2013. Tom Slay, thank you so much for being with me today.
Always a pleasure to see you, Paul.
You can subscribe to this podcast and other free New Yorker podcasts in the iTunes Store. You can hear more poetry read by the authors in newyorker.com and on the digital edition for tablets and phones at no extra charge from the App Store or from Google Play. The theme music is The Pintigree Ferryman from the album The Highlander's Farewell by Alastair Fraser and Natalie Ross from Colburny Records. The New Yorker Poetry Podcast was produced by Jill Duboff of NewYorker.com with help from Elizabeth Dennison.